Hello and welcome to the ILO's Future of Work podcast. I'm Zeina Awad. It's been called the greatest challenge of our times. Climate change is wreaking havoc around the world, from storms and flood to desertification and record heat waves. The impact of the climate crisis is all around us and clear to all. But who is suffering the most from this crisis? And conversely, who's getting the most support to protect themselves from the impacts of climate change? Well, the ILO recently published its flagship report on social protection, the World Social Protection Report 2024 to 2026, Universal Social Protection for Climate Action and a Just Transition. And the report shows the crucial role that social protection measures like unemployment benefits, healthcare, child benefits, and emergency payments can play in countering the worst impacts of climate change. It also showed how central social protection is to getting workers to support the green transition and to ensuring that jobs in a low-carbon economy are decent and secure. Well, joining me today to talk more about this are Shahra Shoub Razavi, the director of the Social Protection Department at the ILO, the department that produced this very important report, and Kumi Naidu, Payne Distinguished Lecturer at the Center on Democracy, Development and the Rule of Law at Stanford University, and a longtime human rights and climate justice activist. Welcome to the show, Shahra and Kumi.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shahra, I'd like to start with you. Can you tell us a little bit more about the key findings of the report? What do the findings imply and why do they matter?
Thank you, Zeina. And it's great to be with you and with Kumi for this podcast. So what the report shows is how social protection systems can protect people against the everyday risks that we face, everyday life cycle risks that we have, whether it's losing a job, whether it's getting sick, getting old. All of these risks, which we have said, you know, in all previous reports as well, are the risks that we face from cradle to grave. Many of these are going to become aggravated in the context of the climate crisis. All of these are going to increase the risk of sickness, the need for healthcare, without financial hardship. We also know that the kind of changes that our economies and societies have to go through are going to increase the risk of unemployment for many workers who will have to shift from different sectors to from old brown sectors, if you like, to new, more sustainable green sectors. Now, these shifts don't happen automatically. People need, for example, unemployment protection. So what we say is that there is some ground for optimism. We have, for the first time, social protection that's covering over half of the world's population, 52.4% to be clear, which is up from 42.8% in 2015. But, you know, this is a modest progress. And if we were to proceed at this rate, it would take 49 years for everyone in the world to have a minimum coverage of social protection. And we also know that that what these numbers mean is 3.8 billion people today have no protection whatsoever, whether they fall sick, whether, you know, they're losing a job, whether they're old and cannot work and need some form of income security. So these risks are very real for billions of people. And we also know that, you know, we're all not in the same boat. We are living really worlds apart. In high-income countries, almost 86% of the population has coverage. When you look at lower, upper middle-income countries, it's about 71% and making progress. But low-income countries, unfortunately, it's not even 10% of people who get coverage. So we are really, you know, living in this world that is highly unequal. The kind of protection gaps that we're talking about are affecting billions of people, particularly those who are in the global south. And the other fact that comes out of the report very strongly is that countries that are most vulnerable to climate catastrophes, they're mostly in the tropics, and they're truly ill-prepared. When we look at the 20 most climate vulnerable countries, about 91% of the population lack any form of social protection. That's about 364 million people. And if you expand that and look at the 50 most climate vulnerable countries, about 75% of the population has no form of social protection. These coverage gaps are really serious. We need to address the reasons for this underinvestment, which I hope we can get into.
You said something. You mentioned the injustice and the global south. Now, I want to turn to Kumi, because Kumi, you are an African, a longtime human rights and climate activist. You're from South Africa. And obviously, Africa has a lot of the countries that are deeply affected by climate change, by the climate crisis, but who at the same time have minimal social protection. So when you first read this ILO report, what was your reaction? What did you think?
Thank you, and greetings to your listeners. Firstly, I would say that I've reviewed many UN reports over the last decades. This ILO social protection report is probably by far the most important and the most timely report that I have seen. If each of our governments and the social partners in labor and in the private sector can take this report seriously, we can have a seismic shift in terms of how we actually address the most vulnerable people who are impacted by climate injustice. And why I say climate injustice, as Shara correctly said, that the people that are paying the first and most brutal price already now, and those that will continue to pay a price should we not turn things around fast, are going to be people living in the most vulnerable countries. And it's important to just remind ourselves, when we're talking about the most vulnerable countries in the global south, that 88% of the world's population lives in those countries that we say are most vulnerable. So we therefore, I think, and the report inspires us to reimagine social protection as the infrastructure of hope in our climate journey. This means envisioning a world where social protection isn't reactive, but proactive, anticipating climate impacts and building resilient communities, you know, from the ground up. Think, for example, of universal basic income schemes tailored for climate vulnerable regions, providing not just financial security, but the freedom for communities to innovate and adapt. Envisage public works programs that not only provide employment, but also engage people in restoring ecosystems, building flood defenses, or planting urban forests. So an approach which is about empowering individuals and families to participate in creating their own sustainable futures. By doing that, we foster communities that are not just surviving, but thriving in harmony with the environment. So for all of those reasons, this report is one that I hope and pray that governments will not let sit on a shelf somewhere, but to really take it seriously and make sure that the different recommendations are actually realized.
Indeed. And in fact, when one looks closely at the report, one sees that it tackles two areas and makes two key arguments. The first one is that social protection can soften the impact of the climate crisis by extending social protection to protect those who are most vulnerable. The second one is that social protection can also help to alleviate fears that some communities may have about the green transition. Mm-hmm. And one can understand these fears, because if you've been working in a coal mine all your life in South Africa, for example, and all of a sudden you're told your job's going to disappear, you're going to have some fears. When you hear these two arguments, Kumi, do they make sense to you and do they resonate? Have you heard this come out of the communities, climate-affecting communities that you've met with throughout the course of your career as a climate justice activist?
Absolutely. These are justifiable and valid concerns. That is why this report calls for a just transition. And we in the climate justice movement see the people that work in the fossil fuel industry, for example, and other polluting industries as our brothers and sisters. They should not be punished for a failure of leadership to guide them to clean, renewable energy systems. It is important that we understand that just transition must also apply to, firstly, people in other industries, like in agriculture, which employs more people, and to ensure that if, for example, if it's older workers who are close to retirement, they should have retirement benefits secured. If it's younger workers, they should be invested with new skills to deploy those skills in a new renewable energy driven economic system, and so on. But also, it's important that we don't forget the communities that rely on the existence of a facility like a coal plant, because it's so big, employs so many people. So it's the woman who sells vegetables outside a coal plant, for example. If you shut the coal plant down and you compensate just the workers, important though that is, and don't take care of the people who have small businesses that are completely reliant on that facility, then we actually fail to ensure that there's a just transition. The other point that I just wanted to bring in is to kind of link the language of loss and damage and the language of social protection. Because loss and damage, it addresses the impacts of climate change that are not avoided through mitigation or adaptation efforts. It refers to the harm caused by climate-related events, such as extreme weather events, like sea level rise, which can lead to significant social, economic, and environmental losses. So integrating the concept of just transition and social protection involves ensuring that vulnerable communities have the necessary support to deal with these impacts in a fair and just and equitable way. And I believe that taking those two concepts together, social protection and loss and damage, is a very important thing for us to do.
If I can just add one more point to what Kumi has just said in terms of the potential of social protection, particularly when it comes to the kind of policies that are needed, you know, the mitigation policies, how to reduce, carbon emissions. We have many international agencies, governments talking about the need to reduce subsidies, to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, to reduce the kind of subsidies that are provided on different sources of, not very clean energy. And the difficulty of governments sometimes removing these subsidies, the fossil fuel subsidies, because of the fear among many sections of the population about the price increases. And there have been examples of, countries where there has been an attempt to reduce these subsidies. And then you've had big protests and they've had to sometimes reverse the policies. This happened in 2019 in Ecuador, for example. And here, I think the role of social protection is absolutely key. But it's important to have the right sequencing. I think you need to have the kind of income support measures, transfers, cash transfers in place that will really reduce the fears and anxiety that many people will have about price increases, and to assure them that their income and their living standards will be maintained, and to have some effective measures in place before these subsidies are removed. So here, social protection can be very helpful. And in fact, once you can put some measures in place to reassure people, and particularly having that important social dialogue, having discussions with trade unions, with employers, particularly small businesses who will also be affected by price increases, electricity price increases, energy price increases, to be able in an orderly way and based on some constructive, discussion and social dialogue, put in place the policies to remove the subsidies and divert some of the savings that is possible to building stronger and more adequate social protection systems. I think this is also really key and needs to be taken into consideration alongside the issues of, loss of jobs and livelihoods that is absolutely key and central to having a just transition.
Indeed, indeed. Social dialogue is very much at the heart of building consensus, especially on issues that are sensitive for many. The other element that is central, of course, is climate finance. Why is climate finance, why is that argument about the role of wealthier countries and their responsibility when it comes to climate finance not resonating as much as it ought to, Kumi?
Well, firstly, we have to just remind ourselves, how did we get here, right? So-called rich developed nations have built their economies on dirty energy. They extracted some of these resources like oil, coal, and now gas from parts of the global south. And they have ignored what the science said for decades and decades. And they colluded. The governments colluded with the fossil fuel industry, the oil, coal, and gas sector, to keep the public misinformed about the threat of climate change. The truth is, if there was political courage on the part of our leaders, we can move much faster in realizing a commitment, by the way, that the G20 made already in 2009, which was to reduce and scrap fossil fuel subsidies. It's gone more than a decade. That commitment has not been realized. So governments know what they should do. They even agree what they should do, powerful governments, and then they just walk away from it and we see behavior that is opposite. So this report holds the promise of forcing our governments to actually wake up and smell the coffee and understand that we are running out of time very, very fast. And so the way we sell it is finding the right balance in the narrative between historical redress and self-interest. So with historical accountability, let's be clear that the countries that have built the economies, when we ask for contributions to the Loss and Damage Fund or the Green Climate Fund and so on, from the Global South, we're not asking for charity. We're just asking for paying one's climate debt, that if you built your economy on dirty energy and that's how you got ahead and others were left behind. But there's another reason, and that is rich nations must understand that it's, while it's true that poor countries are paying the first and most brutal price in terms of impacts, it's not as if the developed nations of the world are not going to face impacts and are not facing impacts, you know. And so it's also in the self-interest, which needs to be elevated, right? The self-interest of wealthier nations to recognize by supporting poor nations not to follow the same dirty energy pathway, they are also acting in their own interest by preventing climate shocks and extreme weather events in their own societies.
We are almost out of time, so I just want to turn to you, Shara, if you have any closing final thoughts.
Well, I think a lot of what needs to be said has already been said very well by Kumi. I just want to sort of maybe highlight that we do have a kind of historic opportunity at this point in time. You know, we're going to be moving into the discussions around financing for development in 2025. I think this is really the moment to be thinking about how to do good on that sort of notion of global solidarity that I think is not sufficiently present. And I think we need to really find the means of supporting countries. And at the moment, our global financial architecture is not really set up for supporting countries in finding the finances and the resources that they need in order to put them into building these social protection systems, public services, and other necessities to make people's livelihoods, you know, sustainable and to create the kind of decent livelihoods and decent jobs that we really need to see more of as we move forward. So I think there are opportunities in 2025 coming up, and I think we need to seize them and move forward in order to really avert the kind of catastrophes that are surrounding us at this moment.
Unfortunately, we have to leave it here. So thank you to both of our guests today, and thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. You can read the full report, World Social Protection Report 2024 to 2026, Universal Social Protection for Climate Action and a Just Transition, on our website. You can also get updates on the ILO's work by following our social media channels. Our handles are at ILO on Facebook, LinkedIn, TikTok, and X. On Instagram, we're at ilo.org. Once again, thanks for listening and join us next time. For now, goodbye.